This is Noisy People. I'm Tim Perkis. Today, my guest is composer and analog synthesis pioneer, Doug Liner. Who invented the electronic music synthesizer, and why did they do it? I thought I should dig into this a little bit, give some background to explain my guest Doug Liner's place in musical history. Well, as in most fields, there was an army of inventors, each one leading to the next. Early on in the 19-teens and 20s, the notion of making sounds electrically and electronically came up, but these instruments were thought of simply as new sound resources, to make music conceived of and played in more or less conventional ways. But later, after World War II, musical avant-gardists became interested in making a music whose very body, structure, and organization grew out of exploiting the semi-wild but guided operation of electronic circuits themselves. This sort of embodied abstraction was first done by repurposing various laboratory equipment, combining oscillators, filters, and tape recorders in ad hoc ways to make or record sound sequences and structures. In 1960, German musical engineer Harold Bode published a paper on his notion of cleaning up this mess with a modular music synthesizer, a matching ensemble of sound creation and processing units built into one rack to be freely connected together in multiple ways for different musical effects. And within a few years, Bob Moog on the East Coast and Donald Buchla on the West Coast had developed and released commercial products along these lines, each with their own brilliant quirks and strengths. A third quirky inventor genius of this stripe emerged in the early 70s, Serge Cherepnin, the Russian-Chinese-French-American composer and engineer, and son of the celebrated Russian composer Alexander Cherepnin. Serge had made his way from Europe to Cal Arts in Southern California, along the way studying with Boulez, Stockhausen, and Luigi Nono, among many others. Here's where my guest Doug Liner enters the picture. As a student at Cal Arts in the early 70s, he glommed onto Serge's brilliant realization of the modular synthesis concept and never let go. Over the course of the next 40 years, working steadily on the Serge modular synthesizer, creating living synthesis compositions, and helping through his electronic music magazine, Synapse, to keep alive a culture of analog synthesis that lives and burns ever brighter today. I had a chance to talk with him before a recent performance at the OutSound Music Festival in San Francisco. So, Doug Liner, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
I just was so knocked out when I heard you play in Berkeley at Tom Duff's series. Can you tell me how you started doing electronic music and you got into it? What kind of things you were doing before?
Yeah, well, I came out of kind of a rock background and had rock bands, put out my first record. I think I was in the 10th grade. And at that time, I started playing keyboard organ specifically, but I'd been very influenced already by a good teacher in high school. So I started to get some influences there. I started listening on my own. I quickly found my way to people like you, Krzyzewski, and so forth. And the weirder the stuff was, the more I liked it. But I also liked the stuff that was happening in the rock context. So when I was young, it was really kind of a joy. But then I went to California Institute of the Arts, and where I studied with Morton Subotnick and Hal Budd and Jim Tenney. And so there, you know, my bent towards the more unusual use of music and everything was definitely solidified. And then after Cal Arts, when I graduated from there, myself and a fellow named Bryce Robley, who's passed away some years ago, We were working together at CalArts, and we started a group called Mobius when we got out of CalArts, and we were one of the first bands to perform live with synthesizers. We continued to do that, and those albums were half semi-popular oriented, and the other half was just totally esoteric stuff like we were doing at CalArts. And I went on to some more, you know, really focused rock projects after that and had some success with that. But even there, I used my Surge on stage on my most rock stuff.
This is an excerpt from Primal Machine by one of Doug's early rock bands, Lem.
It's apparent in your music that you have, that there's something about European 20th century music back there behind what's going on. And also 60s minimalism must have had some influence on you. Is that true?
Yeah, both of those things did for sure. When I was at CalArts, I had a chance, not that this was really the introduction to it, but I had a chance to actually meet and talk a lot with Steve Reich because he came as a visiting professor. Well, those things were very influential on me, but even perhaps bleeding into that, or maybe even more so, things like the gamelan, which I played in Gamelan Orchestra, that was a very big influence. And I think that if you look at it historically, obviously that predates the Steve Wrights of this world by many centuries.
And so it was like Javanese music?
Javanese, Balinese music. And so I played actually in the orchestra, playing the idiophones and everything. And I also studied South Indian classical flute at CalArts, and I studied Bushman and Pygmy rhythmic singing.
This is an excerpt from Doug's piece, Pulse Meditation, a live recording made in 2012.
How important was European modernism to what you do, or was that just one thing in the pot, not dominant, but just one of the other flavors in the pot?
It's definitely an influence, and I definitely like the stuff. Definitely listen to it. One of my teachers at CalArts, not one I was particularly fond of, was a student of Schoenberg's, and so I was thoroughly educated in 12-tone music and wrote in 12-tone styles. And some of it really spoke to me, though, like Penderecki really spoke to me, Ligeti really spoke to me, whereas some other people, like Schoenberg, not so much. But the funny thing about the European thing for me was that I really cherry-picked it. As a whole, I was trying to escape from Europe.
Right.
That's why I moved from the East Coast, where I grew up, to the West Coast, where I've lived ever since, because I wanted to distance myself from Europe. The East Coast, academic scene was just entirely dripping with European history, and I really hated it. But I definitely was influenced by it, and there are parts of it that I love. And
so, how important was Morton Subotnick in the birth of your musical direction?
Well, he was pretty important. I had a lot of other influences, but he came as an influence at a really great time for me. You know, he never once patched patch cord in and said, "Hey, this is how you do this." There was never that ever. It was totally about concepts, and very seldomly even about specifically electronic concepts. It was just, well, you could apply them there. He encouraged us not to be shopping list composers, is what he called it.
Shopping list
composers. And that's, basically what he meant there was that, you know, just because you've learned, you know, 50 techniques doesn't mean you need to use them in every piece, every one of them. Yeah, one of the things that I really found that Mort really did for me, that here I am all these years later and it's still informative for me, is that that idea of limitations being an important part of the experience and not trying to lord over a composition, you know, not trying to make it something it's not, you know, let it be what it is. Yeah. Let it suffer from the inadequacies that it has built into it or the brilliances. But, you know, like, you know, don't try to smooth that over. Don't Photoshop that. And, you know, let things be honest.
But, you know, there's something special about the kind of electronic music you do, I think, because it's right on this line between composition in the sense of, you know, you're planning some kind of abstract structure in a sense, but it's completely realized in a physical way.
Yeah.
So it's physically based composition, or you made a mechanism, you made a machine that's making this music that you designed. And that kind of leads me to the question. What's always interested me is the ways in which it doesn't do exactly what you planned and how you respond to that. Because you work with these analog synthesizers that are imperfect servants of your will, you might say.
Right, it's like chasing cats, right?
Yeah, so how does that go into how you conceive, you know, what happens?
Well, the thing about performing with a synthesizer, certainly the kind that I use, I don't mean necessarily like a keyboard synthesizer, because you're still stuck in that keyboard frame of reference, which is truly incredibly limiting. When I work on a piece, I first develop an instrument. You know, I start with a blank canvas, because I don't have standard patches that I use, and I don't have a patch that I leave up all the time. And I know there are people that do all of those kinds of things, and whatever works is just great, but for me that would just bore the living hell out of me. I mean, I would stop playing music if that's how I did things.
So you start with nothing, with no chords?
Pretty much almost every concert I do is all fresh. Occasionally, if I have several real close together, they morph through the experience. But so I start first building an instrument, or several. Usually, I play with more than one voice at a time. But so I build these instruments, you know, and they're made of little patch blocks, but the patch blocks turn into an instrument. It's something that is in process at all times, you know. So when I go up on stage and I'm playing a piece, I've established some number of processes that are operating on that machine. And then my job, as I see it, is to bring out of that what's in there in terms not only of an individual voice, but in the interaction of the voices, because I don't have a huge machine on stage, and so I use a lot of techniques that share resources between different patches and stuff. At that point, I have multiple things running at the same time, and I'm inserting myself in the middle of that circuit, literally, and manipulating and squeezing and, you know, diminishing. And so it's much like a conductor in a way, because I'm actually, you know, bringing up this voice and that voice, except I'm not controlling it out there. I'm controlling it right here in front of me in a very intimate way. And
but it is kind of like herding cats, because they have their own tendencies, and you kind of...
That's right, and utilizing those errant tendencies is part of the beauty of writing for the instrument. Again, it goes back to, what are the limitations of the instrument? Well, you know, I have a very unique instrument, and it has its own very unique limitations and benefits and features, etc. And they are, you know, as much as they are representative of all the options, they're also representative of all the limitations. And so...
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
You've been instrumental in sort of defining a culture of synthesis and helping to really create that whole contemporary tradition of analog synthesis. I wonder how you think of that, or think how that work relates to your own musical work, that kind of community building work.
Well, it does a lot, and I didn't realize it at that time in my life, but that just happened to be the bent that I had. And I came to it kind of by accident. The way that I got going with Synapse was that a person who financed the first couple little pamphlet issues of it didn't want to do it anymore and wanted to find somebody to control it, so to speak, and he called me up, and I had been an advertiser with my band, Lem, I think it was, in the first two issues. And he called up and asked if I would like to be the editor of it. And I said, no, I wouldn't like to be, but I'll buy it from you.
Ah.
So, because I had a very different way of thinking than other people. And so I've always been kind of adventurous beyond any reason to be it, because I didn't have the skills to run a magazine. I could barely spell or write. But I saw that there was a need for this information. And so it's been a really important part for me, because I, through the magazine, through my radio shows and stuff, I've been able to meet all sorts of people, and in addition to the ones I've been lucky enough to study with, which is wonderful itself. All of these people have influenced me a lot, and they've all made me think in bigger terms. A lot of life experiences, learning about how to be generous to other people.
Well, great. Well, thanks, Doug, for talking with me.
Oh, my pleasure. What fun.
This has been the Noisy People Podcast, episode number 10. The musical samples in today's show were taken from Doug's 2013 live performance and composition, Through the Night Reeds. Special thanks today go to my guest Doug Linner, to Tom Duff, Philip Perkins, and to Rent Romus of the OutSound Music Festival. This podcast is available through iTunes and Android subscription and through our website, noisypeople.net, where you can also find images, links, and additional information about the artists and their music. The show is also available through our partner, creativedisturbance.org, an initiative of Leonardo, the MIT Press, and the University of Texas in Dallas. This episode, number 10, was produced in July and August of 2015.